This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Oh, wow. I'm just waiting for a call in from an absolutely amazing, amazing author, adventurer, and he's coming to the program to talk about a wonderful new Nat Geo book. So while I'm waiting for him, I just wanted to remind all of you, you know, I've been giving speeches lately to writers groups and talking to people, new writers, and looking for an agent. And I want to just remind you, if you are looking for an agent, go to Publishers Weekly, click on the news section, and under that section, you will have book deals, and that's every week they list the best book deals that have popped up. And there's one that it's really, well, there are a couple that are really great, but you can tell by who gets the book deals if the agent is good, because an agent who gets, for example, a wonderful six-figure deal is, that agent is really active and really busy and enjoying his or her job. And Anjali Singh of Aisha Pandey Literary Agency just got a six-figure deal for a book by Tessa Hulse. And wow, six figures. And it's a memoir. So, you know, that's really a great, great deal. And even better, somebody got a seven-figure deal. I really love seven-figure deals. And that's Catherine Coulter for her in a two-book deal. And that was such a good deal that Catherine decided she's going to up and move from her previous publishing house, and which was Gallery, and now she's with William Morrow. And that's a pretty fantastic thing. So you can just find an agent through looking at Publishers Weekly. And, you know, for me, I want to tell all of you, you know, Thanksgiving is coming up, and I love Thanksgiving. And one of the things that I most enjoy about Thanksgiving, I'm sure like you, is getting to see people, getting to visit people. If you're not doing the dinner yourself, you get to visit people, perhaps during the weekend. And one of the best traditions that you can start in your family is that whenever you visit anybody, bring them a Nat Geo book, because Nat Geo books are absolutely fantastic. And I am so thrilled. You know, every time I get a Nat Geo book, I get so excited, because and I know it's going to be hours of fun. And so I'm so happy to welcome to the program John Waterman. And John is, well, he's everything. He has done a completely amazing job on a new, absolutely fantastic book, and it's called Atlas of the National Parks. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, well, as I always, I love talking to all of you people at Nat Geo. I think you are so wonderful. You give everyone so many hours and hours of pleasure, and this new book, Atlas of the National Parks, is absolutely amazing.
Well, thank you. It's certainly a hefty tome on my coffee table.
Well, you know, it's a kind of book that, as I tell everyone, if you're going to give a gift for the holidays, you know, instead of bringing flowers, they only last a little while, a week maybe, and a bottle of wine maybe a day. But a Nat Geo book lasts forever, because no one ever wants to give away a Nat Geo book.
Yeah, well, thank you. And I agree. I have a couple of Nat Geo books. This is the second one I've done, but this has never been done before. This is the first ever Atlas of the National Parks. So it's. I'd like to leave it open to different pages on my table so that I can sort of look at a new flower, if you will, every day.
Exactly. And it is. You know, sometimes you just need a few minutes a day just to relax, just to think about something nice, particularly in this time where there's so much news around us, that to just get yourself lost in one of the Nat Geo books, the beautiful photography. I was telling George Stone, you know, that I sit sometimes so long looking at the books that he does. And here, in this case, putting together, you know, since 1888, Nat Geo has been doing amazing work and promoting not just, you know, beautiful photography, but also conservation, the environment. And here with our national parks, people will be amazed at how many beautiful things there are to see, even just in our country. And there are, I think you have what, there are 67 parks, maps of 67 parks in this book.
Yeah, there are 61, actually.
Oh, 61.
We just got a new one in Indiana, Indiana Dunes National Park. We go from the coral reefs of Florida to the Arctic tundra of Alaska, covering these 61 parks. You know, 85 million acres that I've written about and that we've laid out these gorgeous maps for.
And not just current maps, but also some absolutely fantastic historical maps.
Yeah, it was so much fun gathering the maps and selecting what maps to use with which park. And in instances such as Mount Rainier and Grand Canyon National Park, we found some old maps to show what map making was like back 100 years ago, to some of the most state-of-the-art maps that we got either through the National Geographic or in conjunction and collaboration with the National Park Service, with their cartographers at Harper's Ferry. But I work with a team of cartographers, the best in the world at the National Geographic, as well as a selection of photographs from more than 100 different photographers, some of the best images you'll see anywhere.
Well, it must have been a daunting challenge to go through so many wonderful photographs and the other material that's been included in here. But it's a pretty great job, isn't it?
Yeah, this has been a lifetime passion for me. That is, going to wild places and exploring nature. And if you like those things, then you love national parks. So I was honored to be asked to write this book. And I have spent more than 40 years visiting national parks. And not only that, I worked for a couple, Rocky Mountain and Denali National Park. And then the book itself was, as you can imagine, a massive research project to pull it all together cohesively.
Well, I love your book, Chasing Denali. That book I think that was done last year, right? It was last year. And fantastic book too. And the thing is, it's the wonderful thing about your book, people can get into them and they really feel like they're going along with you on some of these adventures. You know, so many people, you know, they hesitate about going out and doing things, but I think maybe you do inspire people too, that first you give the pleasure of just being able to follow in your footsteps, and then I do hope that it inspires people to go out and see these things for themselves.
Well, thank you. And yes, since I was a teenager, it was my dream to share these places, whether through writing or through photographs. And that's exactly what I've done here. It's a massive tome. You mentioned my last book. Well, that was more of a personal and historical narrative. This one covers the gambit from earth sciences like volcanology and tectonics and geology to cultural history and anthropology, as well as paleontology, depending upon the park that I'm writing about.
Well, when now as you're going through the photographs, there must have been some places that you hadn't been to yet. I don't know if you were to all 61 places, but did you find some of the photographs inspired you to see more?
Oh, very, very much so. There is, for instance, one of my favorite images within the book is an aerial of a caldera in Yellowstone that puts everything in perspective with the wonders of Yellowstone National Park, because the people on the roadway in the photograph are reduced to ant size, and the caldera assumes these otherworldly colors. And on the facing page, we have an interesting graphic that explains that underneath these calderas is a super volcano that could erupt 20,000 years from now, or could erupt tomorrow. And when it does, it will transform the landscape of most of the western U.S. But for the time being, at least speaking in geologic time, it creates these amazing wonders like Old Faithful, forcing these scalding waters shooting up into the air. But that's just one of the more famous examples of a national park. And there are places, for instance, like Gates of the Arctic, the northernmost national park in northern Alaska, that's all in the only national park that's entirely in the Arctic. This time of year, it starts getting dark most of the day. And in summer, it's for 2 months, it's lit by continuous 24-hour daylight, and herds of caribou, the western caribou herd, runs across this huge park, chased by grizzlies and wolverine and wolves. So these parks run the gamut from one extreme to the other. Talking about the cold of the Arctic, then there's Death Valley National Park with the hottest temperature in the world, recorded 134 degrees there. And so these are the kinds of things that are not only sort of interestingly shown on the maps and other illustrations, but that I have an opportunity to tell stories about throughout the chapters in the book.
Well, you've done a beautiful job of putting it together, and the way that you write the stories, I think you draw people into the story of the place and wanting to get to know more about it, wanting to visit it. I know I had not really ever thought about going to see the dry tortugas, but just the way you wrote about it, and of course the photographs, I'd really like to see that place. I don't know why, of all the places. I live in Florida, so I've seen the Everglades, and I was born in northern Michigan, so of course, you know, up there we have Isle Royale. When I was a kid, I wanted to be be a ranger out there. I thought it was a perfect job because I could just sit up there and read books and look out. Yeah, so it's exciting how you have put the book together.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and you're living then in the land of national parks, but in Florida you not only have Everglades, but you have Biscayne, and then of course on my list, I would love to visit Dry Tortuga. I've never been to it. Few people do go there. It's one of the least visited national parks, like Isle Royale. It's just you have to take a long boat ride to get to some of these parks.
Yeah,
and I would encourage your listeners to visit these places, these parks, the gems, the least visited gems, if they want a real national park experience, at least in terms of connecting with nature. And
yeah, I think everybody doesn't have to go to Yosemite. Enough people.
Right.
Please,
yeah.
I don't want...
One of the 10 most crowded.
Yeah, it's overcrowded. You really don't, you know, it's... Unless you hit the right time, the right day, it's really almost it's worse than walking down, you know, Fifth Avenue in New York. Sometimes the trails get so crowded. But there are, as you said, so many wonderful and unseen places, and I think that would benefit from people visiting them and getting to know them and talking about them, because it's so important. I think, you know, what Nat Geo does, of course, is once you are become a fan of Nat Geo books, and like as I was telling George, you know, I still have all the yellow magazines, you know, that all the way back from the 50s, when my father was getting them, that once you read these books and read the stories from wonderful writers like you, it just, you naturally become interested in the environment, interested in conservation.
Yeah. Yeah, I grew up the same way with the yellow magazine on the coffee table. So again, I'm honored to have been invited to do this project.
Well, they invited the right person because, as I said, you're writing. You know, photographs are absolutely fantastic, and you can just lose yourself in them. But I think it's so important that the person who writes about these places, the person who draws you into the story, has to be a great writer, and you are. And as I said, your previous book, which I read last year, I didn't get to interview you, but I read the book anyway, because I think you're just such a fine writer.
Well, thank you. What was it that you liked about the previous book?
Well, you know, I've always wanted to do more backpacking and that type of thing. And the thing is, because I lived in Europe for many years, and so I spent a lot of time, you know, going to areas in Europe. I did, of course, in Switzerland and Austria and northern Italy. We used to do a lot of walking, and we used to go to all of these places. And then when I came back to the States, I started to say, well, you know, there are so many beautiful places here. And, of course, the mountaineering in Denali is, well, it's just one of the things I've always sort of liked gold mines, and I've always wanted to go. How could I find another entrance to a gold mine? I don't know why I have this obsession since I was a kid. You know, but it's just, it's a delightful book. And I think that, you know, you, again, it's drawing us into the story. I didn't know much I didn't know a lot about Denali when I got the book, but it's part of my sort of, the things I hope to do, the things that places I hope to go. And I've been so busy on the radio here, but when I get some time off, I want to go to some of these places. And I certainly think that, you know, you capture the essence of excitement. I mean, you just love to be out there. You're a real adventurer.
Yeah, and, you know, Denali is one of my favorite national parks. And in this Atlas of the National Parks book, I had the opportunity to expound on things that I'd normally had written about, the wolves and the wildlife populations and the history behind the actual creation of the park, why they created this park actually as a game reserve to save the populations of sheep that were being decimated by poachers. Even though it's a national park that has the tallest mountain in the world, there are many other wonders there. But I will spend the rest of my life visiting national parks and maybe eventually getting to all of the most remote ones. Certainly I've had the opportunity to do that in Alaska, but in the lower 48, I've yet to visit Dry Tortugas and Isle Royale. So they're high on my list.
Yeah, well, that's part of the fun of as I was, I always tell all of my listeners that really, Nat Geo books are so good in so many ways, and for young people, the young, you know, the children's versions of Nat Geo books, again with the beautiful photography, these are the things that we need to have in order, and like this book. I mean, I am sure that anybody with children should just get this book and sit with them, and it's a conversation piece. And as a homeschool mom, one of the things that I used to do, we went on adventures. We went on adventures. So my boys, by the age of three, one of their biggest adventures was we would travel the Orinoco River. And, you know, nobody knows where the Orinoco River is if you ask people. But this is one of the adventures, and we'd take different rivers, and we would make boats, and we would make trains and things out of dining room chairs, and we went on adventures. And so this opens up so many possibilities for people with children and grandchildren. Open the book to any place and say, well, let's make an adventure. Let's go here and, you know, put the kids with their backpacks and go to a local park and talk about, you know, you're in another place. You're not in the local neighborhood park. You're on your way to Denali, and you're going to make a climb like, you know, just like John Waterman. You're going to be an adventurer. And I think that's the wonderful thing about it, that you really can turn this book into so many, many different things, a real conversation piece, a real educational thing. And I think you've just done a beautiful job.
Well, I've loved maps for all my life. And, you know, the legendary editor, Gilbert Grosvenor, of the National Geographic, said many years ago that a map is the most epic of all poems. And that's what really makes this book unique, in addition to the narratives and the inspirational images, that it's rich with maps, whether the old maps or these new National Geographic maps. Some chapters have as many as five maps in them, alongside graphics and illustrations. So this is also, I'm told, and I'm doing it myself, the perfect Christmas or holiday gift. I'm giving away 2 dozen of them for this year.
They are. They are just absolutely perfect gifts. And as you said, the maps are fantastic. I have a trunk full of maps, because when I went, as I said, I lived in Europe for so long that wherever we went, I would get a map. And I cannot ever throw out a map. I will just open that trunk and I will pick one out, and it's a reminder of a wonderful, wonderful adventure. So, it's absolutely fantastic, and I think you've done a great job. And I want to thank you, John Waterman, for doing this book, and Nat Geo for sending it to me, and really everyone out there, get this book. It's a perfect gift for holidays, a perfect gift that really will last a lifetime.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure talking with you. Thank you for having me on your show.
Okay, and whenever you have a book, you make sure that you get on my list and get here on the program, because I would love, as I said, one of the things I liked about the Denali book was it was a very personal book. You really told about your emotions and your excitement about being in, doing the climb, and I love that kind of book. So I look forward to having you back on Joy on Paper soon. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Same to you. Bye bye now. Okay, we're gonna have a quick commercial break, and then I will be right back.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660, or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read, if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back, and I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper a fantastic new author. Well, she's been writing for quite a while, but she's new to me, Elaine Clayson, and the name of the book is Love is a Rebellious Bird. Hi, Elaine.
Hi there, Patsy. How are you?
Okay. Do you pronounce it Clayson or Clausen?
It's Clausen.
Clausen. Clausen.
Yeah.
Okay. Elaine. Great. I was, you know, I've been having quite a I don't know, it's a thing. You know, I always get these things in sort of a, they come in threes or something like that. Like a few months ago, I got a lot of books about a particular subject. And so it was strange, completely unrelated, you know, in a, unrelated authors, and they're writing about something that was almost the same. And then I get your book, and it's not that you write about anything that's the same. It's really quite an incredible book, but it is by an author who, you know, starts later in life and writes. You have written an absolutely wonderful book. I was so amazed as I'm reading this, and people will say, well, Patsy, why do you say that it would make a great film? It's because I had been a screenwriter. And so when I'm reading a book, if I see it as a movie, that's just how I feel. And now this book, which is told in second person, it's a very personal book. Why don't you set it up and tell us about it? Then I'd like to talk about the whole writing process, how you develop the story. But what do you like to tell people about the story?
Well, thank you first for your very wonderful and warm accolades. I really appreciate that because I think it is a different kind of book. I think my leading question was, why do we love the people we love? And I set out to try to analyze, of course, not scientifically, it's not a scientific book, but I tried to analyze the factors that go into love. And I then set up chapters that relate to each of those things that maybe contribute to why we love someone. And these chapters are called beauty and magic and being seen and so on. And the way that I wanted to introduce that idea of why we love the people we love is a woman who loved the same man for 60 years. They were not married, and they went in and out of each other's lives, but they met as children, and the book ends with them being old people.
Well, and a lot happens in between. It is a lot.
I hope so.
Oh, boy. Quite a life for both of them. But as you say, she loves the same man all through those years. It doesn't die. It doesn't. I was thinking to the first boy I kissed. I couldn't stand him today.
Oh, you couldn't?
You know, no way in the world. And I'm like, woo, you know.
Yeah, that actually might have been true for me of the first boy I kissed. But he was not the first boy that she kissed.
No.
They were friends.
But I'm thinking, boy, if I couldn't even stand that.
No, I know what you mean. We generally grow and change. In this case, I think my view was of Love is a Rebellious Bird was informed by my one of my very late high school reunions, and I looked around me at the high school reunion, and I saw all these people that had been the popular crowd and the sporting crowd and so on. But I saw this man who had been the golden boy. Everything about him was beautiful. He was physically, he was still physically beautiful as an old guy. He became successful, as everyone knew he would. He was brilliant. He was charming, and every girl adored him. And I wondered what would happen with one girl who adored him when they were kids, when they were children, and never stopped loving him her whole life, although they both had other people in their lives, they both had marriages, divorces, widowhood, and still he was deeply embedded in her, and almost, as she says in the book, as Judith says in the book, the definition of what love is, he became that for her.
Well, Judith is a fascinating character, and of course she's in love with Elliot, and you know, as I'm reading the story, there's a few times I say, "Oh, get over it," you know. Like, but there is something beautiful in a love that can last that long. As I said, it's so funny when you talk about the golden boy from high school. The golden boy from my high school turned out to be a really horrible fat slob. So you know, you never know. You never know. It's nice that your golden boy stayed good looking, but it's funny. You never know. I remember I told one girl I was teaching Sunday school and she was saying, "Well, I couldn't love that guy because you know he's skinny and he's scrawny and I said, "You never know. They fill out and they look really great, and the one who's a really gorgeous jock can turn out to be terrible. So you never know."
Right. That's so true. It's so true. In this case, Elliot remained the golden boy, and they did check in with each other. It wasn't as if they had 50 years between their meetings, but they came in and out of each other's lives, even though Judith was on the West Coast and Elliot was on the East Coast, being a fabulously successful lawyer. But they kept coming into each other's lives with some frequency, and in some cases some passion, and in some cases friendship. So he did remain the golden boy for her, and I think you mentioned something I thought that was interesting, you know, whether he was a fat slob or you could never imagine being with him. One of the things that I say contributes to love is the senses, how we smell someone, how their touch touches us. And so that there is a chapter called Sensory Fulfillment where she tries to examine, could she have loved him? And I wondered about readers too, could they love someone that doesn't have that sensory fulfillment or that sensory hit for them? They don't like the way they smell. They don't like the way their touch touches them. So I think it is part of it. Can we love without that?
Well, it is fascinating. Of course, you have a background in psychology, so this is partly, I mean, why you're able to write this story really in such a compelling manner.
Well, thank you. Again, I do have a PhD in psychology, and I have a background in academia. I was a college professor for 30 years at one of the Cal State campuses. But I think that even if I hadn't this background in psychology or studied it, or maybe it's a chicken and the egg question, I do have a compelling interest in relationships. I mean, you know, my husband teases the hell out of me because I read People magazine, and he just thinks that, you know, how could somebody with a PhD be reading People magazine? Mm-hmm. And I love all that stuff about relationships, and I go to a party and I look at people and I imagine, and I just am very interested in relationships, and in love, in the section, you know, the question of love. So, people have asked me, did my background in psychology inform the book? And I don't know. You know, I think it might be my background in just trying to figure out who people are and who they become and what are the early influences that people have.
Now, when did you start writing?
Certainly it was always maybe my secret dream that I had a practical family, and I went to college and got practical degrees in the health sciences. And but always it was there, to want to be a writer, and I was passionate about reading fiction. And then in my middle years, I said to my then husband, who is deceased, I said we were walking down a beach and kind of a getaway from the kids, and I said, I got to try this. I just have to try this to see if I have anything. And with his help, I took a much reduced workload and began to write fiction, and I had some early success, which is what snagged me. I won some awards. I won some impressive writers' residencies, but I never had. I had some short stories published, but I didn't have a novel published until this one. But in my middle age, I began to get pretty serious about writing, and I didn't treat it as a hobby. I took every available hour and moment and sat in the writer's chair and really worked at it, feeling that I just had to get good. I mean, I believed that if I worked really hard, I would get good enough, and they wouldn't be able to not publish me. So,
And you got good enough, and now the book is nominated for Best New Fiction 2019 Best Book Awards?
That's right. That's right. I've gotten great reviews from Kirkus and from Forward and from people who've got the book just came out last week, and so some people have gotten their early ordered copies, and people are telling me that they're very compelled by it, and they like the story. Of course, you know, you write a story and you have no idea whether people are going to be touched by it. So I'm very pleased that they are.
Well, as I said, it is a compelling story. It is a very cinematic story, because, as I said, I'm reading along and I'm thinking, oh boy, she's going to get a movie deal. And so.
Well, I have to tell you that I am on a big panel at the Skirball Museum in March in Los Angeles. And another person on the panel is president of a big movie company.
Uh-huh.
And I'm trying to figure out a way to be kind of cool about it and, you know, whisper. I don't know.
This book has to get into that person's hand. anybody who's in the film business, I was hired a couple of times to take a book and turn it into a script. Now, it's funny. When script writers do that, you're given a book, and so sometimes it's so difficult because there's nothing in that book you want to use. And as a matter of fact, I took one book, and when I finished it, the author of the book came to me and said, well, yeah, but you used only like about 200 words out of my book. I said, well, but those are the 200 best words. And I mean, that's a difficult situation where you have nothing to work with, and I had to make up most of it myself. In this case, any scriptwriter would just love to take it and will actually use more than 200 of your words. Although, you know, when you write a script, it comes down to 120 pages. But
right.
You have a lot of material here, and that's the important thing. There's plenty of material.
Well, who do you see playing Judith?
Oh, wow. There are actresses out there who will kill for this part. I mean, really, literally kill for this part, because this is an Academy Award winning part, I'm telling you right now. So, I'm sure, because they will just love it. And you have wonderful words, too. I have to tell everybody that Elaine has actually written words that one can repeat and that one can use again, you know, in dialogue. So it's funny. I'm sure that when you get there, you talk about it. I'm going to put it on my website. I'm going to put that. I have a section on my website about books that I think should be made into films, and because I love to do that when I get an author whose book really thrills me and that I want to see as a film, because gosh knows there's so little really great material out there. So I'll send you a link and you can then give that too, because people who are in the film business recognize real talent. Of course, they never would want you to write the script because they hate authers writing scripts.
I don't know that I could.
No, you couldn't.
I took
you could.
Screenwriting workshop once.
Oh no, it's very hard to go from writing a book to a script writer. You can do vice versa. That's okay because then you're just adding more material. But it's hard for an author of a really great book to cut those words. Each word. I mean, you've struggled over every word in this book. I'm sure you've written it.
Absolutely.
And rewritten it and adjusted this and changed this. And then somebody comes along and says, well, okay, take this book. This book is what? Let me see. 314 pages. Well, just cut it all down. And we want about 100 pages because they like you to cut it down to about 100 pages. And then they fill in the rest. So, it's too hard. It's painful. Novelists, you know, they suffer. It's like having surgery and cutting off parts of you. Oh, which part don't you need? Which part don't you need? there is a market for this kind of a story because it is a heartwarming story. It's a story about a woman who loves somebody for 60 years, and you a little bit of obsession here, but there's so much material in this story. And it's told, I think the background, I particularly like, I like knowing about Elliot's background and about the delicatessen. And tell us just how you formed those two particular characters. How did you give the backgrounds when you were working on it? You mentioned that you had gone to some, what do you call, writing communities, writing... What do you call it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So on this book, when did you come out with the idea? How did you come out with these two particular characters? Tell us about a little bit about particularly Elliot's background and how you came out with the idea.
Well, I must say that the background was easy because I used growing up in a Jewish neighborhood in Chicago as the foundation for who these people were. People whose parents were maybe immigrants and that put a lot of faith in their kids going to college, getting an education, and doing better than they had. So it's a generation of immigrant families in the north side of Jewish Chicago, and where academia and academic success were very important. So the first scene in the novel shows the two of them in academic competition, because they're two of probably the smartest kids in the class. But Elliot was brilliant, and I think I did base him on this golden boy that I knew all through school, the boy who did well in everything, but besides that charmed the pants off, literally, off of everyone. He was adored because of his charm and wit and maturity beyond his years. So I kind of thought about that boy and who he'd become. And then Judith was a more ordinary girl. She was a nice girl, a cute girl, but she was not in... As high school kids so often do, and cruelly to each other, she was not in his league. But for various reasons, they come together in friendship and compassion because of tragedy that happens. And so I've kind of followed what would be a more ordinary girl with this golden boy and the power struggle between them. because beauty is a very powerful thing, whether it be in a man or a woman. And he was very beautiful. And so he kind of held the cards in this relationship, and I was very intrigued with that. I think there's a power struggle in every relationship, and sometimes it goes back and forth, and sometimes one person has the power always for the whole relationship. Sometimes one person is just more powerful. And so in this relationship, it was Elliot that held the power throughout their years, even the power to prevent Judith from telling him how much she loved him. Because she knew if she told him how much she loved him, it would all be over. They wouldn't be able to have the relationship they had. So she concealed that. I think sometimes women do. They don't show how much they're in love. And so I then was intrigued with the idea of what happens when the power shifts because of something that happens in their lives. So I think that's one of my underlying interests in... And you asked where it started, and I think it started with this idea of a very handsome, articulate, brilliant boy who's loved by a more ordinary girl.
Well,
and that's where they came from.
Of course, as you said, you had gone to some writing communities.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about, I've always been interested in Hedgebrook. What did you...
Oh, I was at Hedgebrook, and
yeah.
It was just one of the greatest gifts that could be given a writer. They created five little cabins in the woods on Langley Island outside Seattle, a ferry ride from Seattle. But the thing that makes it so amazing, it was started by a very wealthy woman, Nancy Nordhoff, who is from a shipping family. And what she did was create a community, the ideal cottage for a woman writer. What would a woman writer want if she could have her perfect writing cabin? And wow, was it. It was in the woods, but I felt very safe because there was, I don't know exactly how, but there's pretty good security. And I was there with five writers. I was in the cabin directly after Gloria Steinem left it.
Oh.
And I know that because each cabin contained a log where people would write what they felt after they left the cottage. And they were there for either 1 month or 1 week or sometimes even longer. And Gloria Steinem had been in my cottage right before me, and I felt very special about that and what she wrote.
So how long were you there? What... Did you win? You applied and you won it?
Yeah, you apply. Yeah, it's very selective. I was very early in my writing career, as I said, when I was still testing out, do I have it? Do I have what it takes to be a writer? And I submitted a story to them. And I did win that award. And, you know, I was a young single mother. Not young. I was a middle-aged single mother. So this was an unbelievable gift. To have that peace of being in the woods, and they brought you your breakfast in a basket, and They brought you your lunch in a basket. You didn't have to think about food. And for dinner, we'd all meet in the main house and share each other's work. We would read to each other, the five writers. So it was really a gift, something I'll never forget. And I do thank them in the book, because it happened a long time ago, but it was something that gave me a lot of confidence that I could do this, and I just had to keep working, and eventually a novel would be there.
Well, definitely when you're selected for that, because I've heard about it. I think the first writer I've had on who actually won it. I know a few people who, you know, applied and didn't get it, and so they certainly saw something in you, and it has proven... They have been proven right, because you have come out with a novel that it's quite remarkable. As I would say, it's funny. I've had so many people lately, also from Chicago. I just interviewed last week Mary Fleming, also from Chicago, and an author who started late in life, and she wrote a book called The Art of Regret, and she's an expat. She lives in Paris, and she's lived there for 40 years.
Right.
But she started late in life, and that's, I mean, one of the reasons I named my program Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. that it is never too late. You can start any time. And you certainly have proven it. You've come out with I'm sure it will win many awards, and it will be made into a movie. And I hope you will invite me to the premiere, because...
I certainly will. I'll say that I heard it here first.
Okay, absolutely, because I think it will be. And have a wonderful time in Los Angeles. I'll send you a link to my recommendation that the book be made into a film. And again, thank you so much. Elaine Klassen? What did you say?
Klassen.
Right. Klassen. Elaine Klassen. Okay, we'll remember that name now. And the book is available wherever books are sold. Do you have a website you want people to go to?
I do. It's ElaineKlassen.com. I'd love for people to look at that. I write a column, and all the columns are there as well.
Okay, and it is spelled with a K, K-L-A-S-S-O-N. And I think we'll be hearing a lot about you and from you in the future.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to speak with you. Really, really, really great.
Okay, bye-bye, Elaine. Bye.
Goodbye.
Okay, another. Oh, this is one wonderful. I'm just hitting a jackpot here. So many books that I think will be great films, and you know, this part of this Me Too movement. There are a lot of books being written about women and for women, but not all of them sort of hit the mark, and this definitely does. And it is truly a fascinating story. There aren't a lot of books written in second person, so it's unusual. And once you get into it, when you first start, some people say, "Well, I don't know if I'll like a book written in second person," but you will. Believe me, you will. You'll get into the story, and you'll forget, and you'll be like me, and you'll think that you're walking through a film, and you will enjoy it. And also remember that she started late in life. And Mary Fleming, who was on the program last week, she started late in life. And even later in life was my wonderful, wonderful guest, who's going to be 97 in February, and she's going to be on the program. And that's Eugenia Lovett West. And her book is called Firewall. And she's 96 right now. And you never know. That's what I'm always telling you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, a streaming video, or perhaps even a series on the Hallmark Channel. You never know, and you won't know unless you start writing a page a day. And in a year, you can have a big fat book that you can start you can start editing. Anyway, it's lots of fun. So get there and start writing. And meanwhile, today, say something nice to somebody, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room, and he's saluting me, and I'm saluting him, because I wish I had been a general. I love to order people around. Bye-bye now. Have a wonderful weekend.